This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 99th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have today with me Michael Hicks. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Gary.
Michael Hicks is a professor of computer science at the University of Maryland. He co-directs the Plum Lab, focused on programming languages. He's also affiliated and served as first director of the Maryland Cybersecurity Center, called MC2. By the way, I advise MC2. Michael's research interests focus on software availability, reliability, and security. He recently kicked off the Programming Languages Enthusiast blog with Swarat Chanhudri. I hope I said that right. Is that right? Chanhudri?
Pretty close.
Michael holds a BS in computer science from Penn State and a PhD in CIS from Penn. In his spare time, he plays Ultimate, coaches youth soccer, and plays drums. He lives in College Park, Maryland. So you're in Scotland now at PLDI.
That's right.
What's the conference about, and what's the best thing you've seen or done so far over there in Edinburgh?
So PLDI is one of the top academic conferences in programming languages research. So it stands for Programming Language Design and Implementation. And the location of the conference bounces around the globe, often in the U.S., sometimes Europe, sometimes elsewhere. The research that is presented at the conference covers a pretty broad spectrum, and some of it covers things about how programming languages can influence and hopefully improve security. In terms of the best thing that I have seen, one talk that just happened maybe a half an hour ago that I liked a lot was looking at how to improve the implementation of control flow integrity, which is a security property that well-behaving programs we hope will satisfy. And this property was proposed quite a while ago and was shown to be able to defeat things like return-oriented programming attacks and standard buffer overruns and things like that, but it was found that the performance overhead was too high. So the paper today showed how we could sort of have our cake and eat it too by enforcing this property and dialing down the overhead quite a bit. So I'm kind of excited about that result.
Cool. That sounds great. So it sounds like a mostly academic conference, but often as these conferences go and this research goes, some of this stuff will find itself in the commercial tools eventually.
We hope so, yes.
So regular listeners know that I'm pretty passionate about programming languages, just like you. In fact, I started in security when Java came out in 95, and we were wondering, what's the deal? They're calling this programming language secure? So everybody who listens really has heard a fair amount about type safety and closure. And I'd like you to explain why those properties slash mechanisms are important for security, if you would.
So one of the problems with establishing security of a software system is being able to reason about its various components and how they interact. And one property that makes reasoning about these components independently, a property that helps a lot, is type safety. Type safety is when a language guarantees it, it ensures that you can write these different components and the types of those components explain how the components are going to operate, and do not the components will not be able to sort of break out of their little sandbox to affect other parts of the software system.
So I guess languages, you might want to explain that some non-type systems have, you know, things where you can point to a glob of bits, and one day it might be an integer, one day it might be a pointer to another pointer, and so on, and that's what type systems are about in the first place.
That's right. So you can think of a type system as a way of proving that programs don't do those things that you just said.
Right.
That there's no way for you to take a pointer, take an integer, take a string, and then start pretending that it's something else, and thereby start breaking properties that you might otherwise assume a same program would have.
Okay. So that's type safety, and type safety is a great idea from, I think, 1959, if I recall my Lisp
that
literature.
That sounds about right.
And how about closure? What's closure about?
So when you say closure, do you mean the closures as in functional programming closures?
Yes.
Or do you mean, okay. So closures are a mechanism by which we can treat functions as objects that you can pass around your program and use to handle various operations in that program. For those people who are familiar with C, you can think of a closure as like a function pointer, but it's a little beefier than that because it will be able to encapsulate part of the environment in which that function was created. And the great thing is that in a type-safe language, a closure can implement a strong encapsulation property so that the state that the function might have access to is not going to be available outside the closure itself. And so again, this is a nice way of being able to build secure systems by constructing them out of components.
Mm-hmm. When you think about a critical section, if you have closure and you want some guarantees about the state of the critical section, closure can help you guarantee that. And when languages don't have closure, like Java didn't have closure, we had to do all sorts of crazy shenanigans to declare all sorts of variables, static, final, to build a pretend closure to do to build the do privilege loop back in the old days. Remember that?
Yeah, absolutely. People have been programming with effectively with closures with a whole lot more syntactic overhead than really they ought to have been asked to use. But now, as you say, they're becoming a sort of first-class feature of many languages, which is a great thing.
So these are two properties that a lot of people who don't really do programming languages in security all day have at least heard of, and they're important. But what other aspects of programming languages, what other properties and mechanisms matter for security? You mentioned one before, so you sort of stole the thunder from this question. But I'm wondering if there's sort of a list of properties and mechanisms that you guys in the research community are looking into.
Well, one of them that goes hand in hand with type safety is safe memory management, often implemented by garbage collection.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the time people think of garbage collection as maybe something that makes programming easier, and most certainly that is the case. But another thing that it does is it prevents a certain class of insidious bugs. For example, if you have a piece of memory in your C program and you free it, and then you mistakenly, because you made a mistake, continue to use the pointer as if it was not freed.
Right.
The problem is the allocator can then reallocate that memory to some other part of the program, even having a different type than the original memory, and now you have two bits of your program operating on the same data, thinking that they have sole ownership of it. And the bad guys are able to exploit this sort of bug and cause your program to do all sorts of things you didn't expect.
Mm-hmm.
Garbage collection just eliminates that problem because there is no possibility for you to free something and then keep using it, because the garbage collector is going to ensure that as long as your program continues to maintain a pointer to that object, it will not get freed. So that's really, really nice for security.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one. Are there others?
I think related to type systems, mechanisms for other mechanisms for implementing encapsulation. So you mentioned closures being one of these things. Programming languages also often have module systems,
mm-hmm.
where the module system allows you to define these different components, and the way that you interact with these components is expressed by the module's interface. By being careful about how you define this interface, you can be sure that the properties that you would like to establish about your module, for example, maybe it contains some private data like an encryption key, that the only way that you can end up interacting with that data is via the module interface and not via some other sort of surreptitious mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's another important feature.
Yeah, that's all good. So the idea is that some of these programming language properties allow you to make security guarantees that you might not get in languages that don't have those properties.
That's right.
So to make this all super ridiculously clear and also very silly, why is C better or worse than Ruby from a security perspective?
So C does not enjoy type safety of the flavor that we've been talking about, because you can take an integer or a string and start pretending that it's a pointer or a function. And as a result, programming errors in your C programs afford an adversary a lot of power in causing that C program to do something bad.
Mm-hmm.
A program written in Ruby, which is type safe, it's a lot harder to affect that sort of power over your Ruby program, because you have this type safe these better abstractions for allowing you to cordon off parts of your program and not allow them to be manipulated in this bad way.
So, I mean, some people argue, I would like the power of C. I like being able to code directly to the metal, and I should be able to keep that stuff straight, which may or may not be true. But don't you think that it would be better if we start using higher level languages that have some of these guarantees that we've been discussing?
That is definitely a thrust of quite a lot of people's effort. That is making these higher level languages, which afford productivity and security benefits, making them also have the performance and flexibility that we've come to know and love in languages like C and C++. And if I may, I'll call out a research project that I started 10 years ago on a language called Cyclone. Mm-hmm. This was along with Greg Morissette at Cornell. Well, he was at Cornell at the time. He's now at Harvard.
Right.
And several other researchers at AT&T and
University
of Washington.
Greg, by the way, is a previous silver bullet victim, so we'll put a pointer to Greg's episode.
So we were aiming at providing a language that has the power and performance of C, but at the same time, the type safety and overall safety, these language features of something like Java or Ruby. And a cool thing is, after doing the research project and building a lot of low-level programs like device drivers and web servers and showing that they did indeed have good performance, we moved on. That's what academics do, and to our next research project. But Mozilla has started a new programming language called Rust. And a lot of the ideas that we explored in Cyclone and that other people at the time explored in sort of safe C variants mm-hmm. are making their way into Rust. And Rust maybe one day will be the foundation of a web browser and one that we can actually rely on rather than expect to have a litany of security vulnerabilities discovered month after month, which seems to be the current state of affairs.
Very good. I like that. One other question about languages, and then we'll turn to something else. Why are dynamic languages like JavaScript problematic from a security perspective?
By dynamic language, most people mean the ability to do things like run eval, right? So eval is a language construct that you can pass it a string, which consists of a lot of code, and that code will then be run in the context of the current program. So that's language feature is giving you a way of plopping in an arbitrary piece of code and giving it access to all the data and other goodies that are in scope in your program at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So if used in an unsafe way, if used in a way that a clever adversary can manipulate the program runs to cause that feature to be executed with a program of his or her choice, right, you're very open to sort of a negative outcome.
Yes, serious injection attacks are available, for example.
Exactly, that's right. So I think it's an unfortunate trade-off that JavaScript is very popular because it is so powerful, and as with many languages like C and C++ that are extremely powerful, you can do great things with them, but if you do not do them carefully, and it's very hard to do them carefully, you open yourself up to serious attacks.
Mm-hmm. I think eval is part of what I was thinking of. I was also thinking about the notion of creating an assembly on the fly, which makes it more difficult to make security guarantees until the code has arrived from wherever or been conjured up from wherever, because if it's not there, you can't check it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. JavaScript, for example, when it's running in your web browser, if you ever do the View Source tab on your browser to look at the code that's actually there, you'll see that the code that's running on a particular web page, what you see in the current source is only a very small fraction, that mm-hmm. it's sort of importing code from arbitrary locations on the web. And who knows what that code is doing, where it's coming from. It makes it very hard to reason ahead of time that going to a particular web page is going to be safe because it is so dynamic.
So this big move towards Node.js and everything compiles down to JavaScript has some downsides from a security perspective.
I think that's right. We do have to be careful to keep the JavaScript language separate from the infrastructure of the web that tends to be the main source of running JavaScript programs. For example, Microsoft is now moving towards having JavaScript is just a standard language that runs in their .NET framework. And in that case, you can control a little bit better where the code comes from and how it's used, mm-hmm. more so than the standard way that people are accustomed to using it in their browser.
Right.
But nevertheless, the dynamic nature of the language kind of encourages this to happen. And so I think it's always going to be a little more dangerous.
Yeah, interesting. So get ready. Here it comes. Another aspect of security I wanted to talk about, because you've done some work in it. What role do you think cryptography plays in security, and what does your research have to say about combining crypto and programming languages?
When you talk to the uninitiated and you say, I work on computer security, the first thing that they seem to think about is cryptography. And that's because cryptography is an incredibly successful part of computer security, and it's been around for quite a long time. And cryptography is great for ensuring that your communications are kept confidential, that those communications are not tampered with. And over time, cryptographers have looked at not just at communications, but also at computations. And as we move towards computing in the cloud, which is a very exciting and promising idea, people have been looking toward cryptography to say, hey, is there a way that we could, say, run our programs on some untrusted cloud provider, or partially trusted maybe, and make it so that they can't actually see the results of our computation? Mm-hmm. They'll run, those providers will be oblivious to what the computation is doing, but we, back at our desks in our offices, will get to see those outputs, but nobody else will. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really exciting idea, and there's been a lot of work on techniques. For example, people may have heard of fully homomorphic encryption as a technique that cryptographers have been working on for quite a while toward this end. My research interest has been in starting to look at these technologies and making them more performant and maybe easier to use by bringing in programming languages ideas. In some ways, you can think of the cryptographers as developing privacy-preserving or integrity-preserving computation technologies. They're kind of like the assembly language of programs. And in order to use these things in real systems, we need to make it easier to combine them with normal code, to take pieces that were developed here, and combine them together, and then also to make them run very fast. Mm-hmm. So this huge field of compiler optimization and performance analysis and profiling and all of these things that have been developed in the context of traditional computing, there's a ways that we can bring them over to this idea of cryptographic computation. And what we've seen in this growing research area is that those techniques can provide orders of magnitude performance improvement, leading us closer and closer to having them be a reality. So I think that's really exciting stuff.
Cool. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. Let's turn next to scientific research, which obviously you do lots of. Tell us about how Scrum and other Agile ideas have influenced the way you run your research group.
No, that's a great question. When I started out as an assistant professor some time ago, I slowly, as is the case with many professors and probably many people just in their lives in general, things got more busy, my activities ramped up, and it became harder and harder for me to keep track of all of the different research and educational activities that were going on in my research lab and with my colleagues. So in the same way, software development organizations, when building big software projects, felt like, wow, we're having a hard time keeping track of all of these different deliverables and milestones and making sure things are moving ahead and getting done in a timely fashion, and sort of predicting how it was all going to go 2 years in advance and then following a schedule sounds great, but it didn't seem really to work in practice. So the agile development community looked at, well, hey, can we do something that is more reactive, that we can have shorter term goals where we're constantly on top of making sure that those goals are being achieved, and if not, we can pivot and adjust those goals and continue to make progress towards ultimately getting a result.
Mm-hmm.
And that approach, whether it be Scrum or extreme programming or whatever it might be, pair programming, has been very successful. So in our research activities, when we found that in the same way, students who were working on research projects maybe were not getting as much done as we might have hoped, or we faculty members were having a hard time being helpful because we were spending too much time on students that didn't need the help and not enough time with students who did, I realized, hey, we ought to use this agile development methodology but apply it to research. And it's a really a very natural idea once you think about it in hindsight that you should put the grease where the squeaky wheel is, and the only way that you can do that is to keep on top of all your different wheels on a regular basis and think in a little bit more short-term way and not in this sort of very long-term, we'll just assume that the results will be there when we get to the end. And that's proven to be very successful. We ultimately wrote a short paper about that approach, and I oftentimes these days meet people at conferences who say, that I've never met before, who say, oh, I read your paper, and now we use this methodology in our group. So that's pretty exciting.
You should have patented it. Oh, well.
Oh, well.
You academics, I tell you. So
I know.
So here's an easy one for you, a different topic. How do you teach computer security?
Well, I like to teach computer security by saying, what are you aiming for and how you might hope to achieve it? And then showing why all of your why being naive and hopeful that you'll get to your end goal is in fact being naive and hopeful, and that there's a lot of things that can really go wrong if you don't think of security right from the start.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, I'm about to teach coming this fall a MOOC, a massively open online course on software security.
Cool.
And I've been thinking very hard about how to put these lessons across for a broader audience. And it's very, it's very challenging. In fact, I took quite a bit of inspiration from your books, Gary, in looking at the black hat, white hat sort of idea of, you know, on the one hand, the white hat wants to do this, but then the black hat comes in and shows how that's not going to work. So the white hat tries to defend that, and then the black hat tries to find the hole in that. And I think the best that we can do is step back and look at some big picture principles like the ones we were discussing at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
that will guarantee a bit of a firm foundation that we can build on while continuing to very carefully monitor what's the state of the art and how we're being attacked and how do we adapt our principles, maybe adjust them, maybe just apply them differently to continue to think about how to build security right in the first place.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask about CMSC 838G, which is software security at Maryland. Anyway, you're teaching that now, aren't you?
I just finished it, yeah.
Okay, and tell us about, you know, how that course was structured, who it was for, what the student demand was like, and so on.
So that course was a graduate level sort of reading group seminar style course where what we did was we wanted to focus on the software side of security.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people, when they think about security, think about network security, firewalls and intrusion detection systems and configurations and things like that. Or they think of system level security like operating systems and access control policies on their file systems and maybe antivirus and things like that. And all of those things are great and we need all of them. At the end of the day, what are those things trying to do? Well, they're trying to protect you from software that's maybe not working quite the way that it should. It wasn't designed properly, so it's vulnerable, or it's got some implementation bugs that could be exploited. So what we wanted to look at was, well, how can we look at how that the software itself, so that we can build it sort of right in the first place,
mm-hmm.
So that while those other aspects of security are important, maybe they'll be less needed because the software will just be better.
Gosh, sounds like
so
a great idea.
I've something that we can agree on. So we looked at a bunch of academic research papers with this black hat, white hat mentality of, okay, you'd like to establish this goal. Well, what are the threats to that goal? And we looked at papers that showed how you could exploit things in a, maybe a surprising way. And then we looked at defenses for those things. So I mentioned control flow integrity before. We read a series of papers about control flow integrity as being one possible way of defending against these sort of exploits that try to inject code into your running program when your program has vulnerabilities in it. And continuing to build on that technique as a foundation, and looking at other methodologies like information flow control and taint tracking and code injection protection by using, say, parameterized queries for SQL, and all sorts of fun technical stuff. So in terms of the way the course was run, we read these papers, we discussed them in class, we had a blog where people were able to put up lots of ideas about what did they think about these ideas and which ones were good ones and which ones weren't. And then ultimately, in the end, they proposed a research project that they carried out to try to, in many ways, build on ideas that they learned about in the class.
Mm-hmm.
If you like, I can tell you about one or two of those projects.
Well, only very, very briefly. And I'm sort of interested in how many students wanted to take that class, what kind of demand there is at Maryland for a grad-level class in software security.
So I would say that so we had 12 students in the class. As a reading, and this is sort of a vagary of the course credit system at Maryland, it's an 800-level class, and so that as a class that counts as an elective, whereas a 600 or a 700-level class counts as core credit.
Right.
So a lot of graduate students spend their time in the core classes because if they're not in their particular research area, they're going to get sort of credit towards their degree, whereas the reading-level classes, those are more people that are directly interested in that topic for the class, mm-hmm. even if they don't get core credit for it.
Right.
So in this case, we had a bunch of sort of software programming languages people and cryptographers and a few systems people who were interested in taking this class. And in the end, it was a lot of work. We had 44 research papers
wow.
that are pretty deep technical papers as part of the class. So I think when the outsiders see that kind of workload, even though everyone, you know, my teaching evaluations are great, they love the class, they learned a lot,
yeah.
Some of the outsiders are a little scared away by that.
Well, you might actually learn something. God forbid.
It, you know, I know.
So I wanted to spend a couple minutes talking about this really cool contest you guys are going to run in August called Build It, Break It, Fix It. So will you tell us about the contest and its genesis and then mention how people can get involved?
Absolutely. So a lot of the things that we've been discussing about programming languages or about development methodologies like Scrum or something like that, have aimed to make software better, to make it more reliable, to make it more available, or to make it more secure. And while those aims are clearly good and the techniques clearly work at satisfying those aims, sometimes people are slow to adopt them. I think a lot of people, despite our discussion at the beginning of this conversation about C and C++, are still not convinced and still want to write their programs in C and C++.
Right, yep.
And they're not sure. Well, yes, there is a benefit from doing it in Java or whatever, but maybe I can just be really careful in doing it in C and C++ and it'll be fine, and I'll get all these performance and flexibility benefits. So really what we need some kind of higher level evidence where we can look end to end. Hey, if I write my program in Java, or I write it using this framework, or I write it using this methodology, can I really show in an empirical way that it's better, that it's more secure than if I just try really carefully when I write it in C to make it secure? So we thought, hey, one way that we could get this evidence is we could have a contest
cool.
where we could ask people to write a program satisfying a specification, just like they, you know, they do at a company for building their product. But now all the teams would be afforded the flexibility to use whatever methodology they saw fit in building these programs. So they could use these safe languages or not. They would be awarded for fast programs. They'll be rewarded for featureful programs. So maybe you'll go beyond just the core set of features that the specification demands. So that's good. That's the way a real product team would be rewarded. But they will also be rewarded for being resilient to attack. And we'll go ahead and we'll simulate attacks by the second round of the contest having specific teams trying to find vulnerabilities using penetration testing or whatever state-of-the-art methodologies they have at their disposal to find bugs in these programs. And in fact, the fun thing is you can participate in round one in the so-called build it round to build the programs, but you can also participate in round two to try to find vulnerabilities in other people's programs and thereby sort of, if you do find them, put your program in a better position.
I really like that.
So at the end of the day, we'll crown winners for both the best build it teams and the best break it teams so that hopefully in the end, we can push the state of the art, we can get data where we factor out a bunch of important variables like, you know, the software is for the same specification, but what's being varied is the people doing it, how much experience they have, what languages they use, what methodology they use, and so on. And maybe we can start to develop some evidence that suggests that, sure enough, these languages are going to give you some advantage, or maybe not. Maybe we'll be surprised, and there will be something else that we'll learn about it instead.
I really like it. So it's kind of like capture the flag for security engineering in some sense.
That's right. Existing capture the flag contests really focus on what for us is round two. You're given some software that's got an Easter egg in it, got a flag in it that you have to find the vulnerability to acquire. And we're saying instead of us providing you that buggy software, we'll let people build software the best that they know how, and then we'll try really hard to find those bugs. So it's really the white hat and the black hat together, and we'll gather data on sort of both sides to find out which techniques work the best.
Love it, love it. We're proud to be playing a little bit of a role in that. So how can people get involved in that contest?
So first of all, you can advertise the contest to students at U.S. universities, and these students can be undergraduates or graduate students. The contest is being funded by the National Science Foundation as part of their cybersecurity education call for proposals, and so we want to get students involved, and we want to promote this idea of teaching people about building security, and so that's why we're sort of limiting it to U.S. College students as supported by the NSF. So please tell people you know who are interested in security to participate in this contest. There's big prizes that hopefully will provide further motivation.
What's the URL
URL is builditbreakit.org.
Builditbreakit.org. Cool.
The second thing they can do is they can support the contest. If they're involved at a company and they want to help us out either financially by helping fund some of the prizes, or they want to help us out by defining contest specifications for programs that people might build, or acting as judges to help out work out various aspects of the contest that require human intervention, or even participate as a break-it team by trying to find vulnerabilities in student submissions. All of those things would be really great, and if you go to the website, there's a document that you can download that explains all the ways that that companies and even individuals could help participate.
That's great. Well, I hope it's a huge success. I think it's a fantastic idea, so I'd love to see it really work.
Well, we really appreciate your support, Gary, and that of Cigital and the other sponsors for the contest.
So last question, which has nothing to do with programming languages, security, or contests. What kind of drums do you play?
I have a Ludwig kit that I bought in college that I think I've changed the heads on it, but I've managed to stick with the drums forever. Uh-huh. And I have a lot of fun playing with a little group that we have in the CS department at Maryland and, you know, banging along with CDs and stuff in my basement.
What's the name of the group? Surely it has a clever name.
No.
It doesn't?
If we ever played out rather than just noodled in the basement and had fun amongst ourselves, we'd have to come up with a name.
So who's the drummer that you admire the most in the world?
I really like all of Sting, Sting's drummers, Vinny Colaiuta and Manu Katché. They sort of bring together a jazz feel, really great technical feeling from jazz and technical ability, but then also they're able to play the backbeat for Sting's music, which is very funky and it's got a nice drive to it.
Yeah, he likes to play stuff in 7 and 5 and all sorts of crazy time signatures just because he's Sting.
He could somehow get away with it.
Exactly. Well, thanks a lot. This has been fun.
Thank you, Gary.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The May-June issue of IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine features the famous Oakland S&P Symposium and issues edited by Terry Benzel. The issue also includes our conversation with Yoshi Kono from the University of Washington about hacking cars. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.